Next case, DKCLM v. Miller. Mr. Olson.
May it please the court, here's the reason the landlord has to go back to court and start over if the time limits for eviction are not strictly observed, and the reason anybody that wants a stay during an eviction process has to go to court to get the stay. These statutes were enacted with these strict time limits to curb abuses that are laid out in beginning in footnote 8 of this court's opinion in Wolf-Lilly, which is quoted near the end of our reply brief. Landlords formerly were able to start eviction actions, get writs of restitution, and then make up with their tenants and put the writ of restitution in their back pocket for months, sometimes over a period of years even, and then some tiff would erupt between the landlord and the tenant. The landlord could take this old writ of restitution out and get an eviction action going without going back to court.
Right, but that sounds like an argument for a per se rule of Fourth Amendment violation any time the writ is executed after its expiration date. And there is no such per se rule. It's just a reasonableness test here. And so we need to grapple with whether, assuming the writ of restitution was expired, and there's a difference of opinion on that, the district court said that it wasn't. So we have to identify the date on which the writ expired. But after that, determine whether or not anything that occurred after that date violates the rule of reasonableness. It's not a per se violation. It's a violation of the statutory scheme, but it's not a per se violation of the Fourth Amendment.
I think a holding that execution of a stale writ of restitution is unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment is compelled by this court's decision in Wolf-Lilly.
Wolf-Lilly said it was deciding only whether Parrott applies to the Fourth Amendment. Let me ask you a concrete question. If Wisconsin law provided that the sheriff has 20 days to execute a writ of eviction, would that violate the Fourth Amendment?
No. If the sheriff executed the writ within 20 days?
So your argument, therefore, is that to violate state law by taking more time than state law allows is to violate the Fourth Amendment. Now, how is that argument consistent with Virginia against Moore?
My position doesn't go that far.
No, I'm asking you a concrete question about how your position is consistent with Virginia against Moore.
Okay, I don't know Virginia versus Moore.
Virginia against Moore is a decision of the Supreme Court holding that a violation of state law does not violate the Fourth Amendment. That the question about the Fourth Amendment is entirely federal, that states are free to add to people's protections without creating Fourth Amendment violations. So if the state says, in addition to what the Fourth Amendment commands, you have to do more, that does not allow a derivative federal suit under the Fourth Amendment. The core of your argument seems to me utterly inconsistent with a recent holding of the Supreme Court.
I don't think it is. I think
you just told me that if Wisconsin allowed 20 days, that would be consistent with the Fourth Amendment. So your argument is precisely that because Wisconsin has allowed a shorter period, there must be a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
No, here's my argument. It's that without a writ of restitution, sheriff going on to take somebody's property off their land would clearly be a Fourth Amendment violation. It'd be a warrantless invasion of private property. The only reason they get to do that is because they have this writ of restitution. That gives them a Fourth Amendment pass, but the Fourth Amendment pass is...
You're making the exact kind of argument that Virginia against Moore rejected. It is that when the state adds protections, if you don't adhere to what the state rule is, it's as if there were no authority for the search. That was the argument of Moore in Virginia against Moore. It flopped.
I do think that the court would have to do something to upset its holdings in Wolf Lilly.
Wolf Lilly is a panel decision of this court in 1983. Virginia against Moore is a decision of the Supreme Court in 2008. Which do you think controls?
If there's a conflict, Virginia against Moore controls. But I don't think there's necessarily a conflict.
Well, I don't see how you can say that when you've already told me you haven't a clue what the Supreme Court decision is.
And there's also the decision from the Supreme Court in 1992 of Soldal versus Cook County, which explicitly applies the rule of reasonableness to evictions. So there was a lot of ammunition on the other side, even without Virginia against Moore.
Well,
so there is no, I mean, that's the import of the Soldal case. There's no per se Fourth Amendment violation once a writ of restitution expires. It's a rule of reasonableness, and you haven't told us what was unreasonable about what the sheriff's deputy did after the writ expired, and we still have a dispute about what day that was, but by my count, it would have been October 11th.
Why did your client drop his suit against the movers?
We came to believe that we could recover any damages that we had at stake through the proceedings against the county, and that we had fewer hurdles by proceeding against the county because there was clear state action.
Why, if the movers lost stuff or damaged stuff, why wouldn't that be a straightforward suit for breach of contract or tort or what have you?
Well, they have some immunities by virtue of their being employed by the county. And
what, the moving companies?
I think so.
They're immune because they have a contract with the county?
I think in the eviction statute there's a provision that provides some immunity for companies that are contracted to assist with an eviction.
So in Wisconsin, if a company is hired to carry out an eviction order and decides to carry it out by blowing up all the possessions using dynamite, they would be immune from liability?
No, I don't think it's that broad, but I think
What is the immunity?
I'm sorry, I don't know it well enough to recite it off the top of my head. We did dismiss the movers.
Isn't it pretty obvious that this stuff that, what he says is worth $2 million is worth nothing?
I don't think so.
It's junk, isn't it?
No, it's marine parts.
What's the evidence that there's valuable property there?
It's his declaration. It's Dale Kreil's declaration.
That's it?
Yes.
Just what he says?
Correct.
No evidence?
Well, that's evidence under Payne versus Pauley and other decisions of this court.
Wait, I'm sorry. What did you? I forgot the beginning of what you said. You said there's no, or I said there's no evidence. Yeah. And you said
Dale Kreil's declaration
is evidence.
It doesn't need
evidence.
Yes.
If the property was valuable, why didn't the plaintiff remove it itself? It had plenty of time. This links into the due process argument. It's what worries me. I mean, normally you say there has to be a need for a hearing. If the state has come along, injured your property, you have to have some opportunity for recompense. But usually, if somebody has a complete opportunity themselves to take the property away and doesn't use that opportunity, they're pretty hard-pressed to complain that somebody else fouled things up later. So why didn't your client take the property away itself?
He was focusing it. I don't know how much of this is in the record. He was gone. I know it's in the record that he was out of town when the eviction was commenced, and it was surprise. It was a surprise to him.
It was delayed, it seemed, almost incessantly. Settled, and then he didn't take it away, and he didn't pay, and then it was settled again, and he didn't take it away, and he didn't pay.
Well,
he wasn't out of town for a year.
He was. The final writ of restitution in August was obtained in an ex parte proceeding based on a representation that the rent had been paid on time that Mr. Kreil
and based on the settlement agreement under which if he didn't pay finally after all of this. But none of this is getting at my question, which is why didn't he take the things away himself? He's not paying for the storage. He's settled in a deal that says, and if I don't pay at long last, you can proceed ex parte.
He thought he paid the rent. He believed he had paid the rent. He didn't know his check had been returned, and he was trying to fight against the writ of restitution itself rather than get his property off the premises. Thank you. I'll reserve my time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Ms. Foley?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Colleen Foley and I represent the appellees, Milwaukee County and now retired Deputy Sheriff Pamela Miller. Your Honors, Judge Randa reached the right result here, no matter how you calculate the triggering of the 10-day clock. Whether you use the September 26th date when the stay lapsed or whether you use the October 5th date when the eviction commenced, Milwaukee County executed a valid writ and did so in a reasonable manner consistent with the Fourth Amendment and taking into consideration the balancing test between the governmental interest and the private interest involved.
What's your position about when the writ lapsed?
The information in the record requires that the court piece together information. I had been focused on
There's a public record, right?
Correct. Yes.
So we know what the court did.
Right.
And we know when the writ was delivered to the sheriff, right? And we know the stay dates.
So
everything we need to know is a matter of public record.
Correct.
So when did the writ expire?
The writ was appears to be delivered to the sheriff's office on September 26th, and so calculating that date going forward, October 11th would be 10 days, excluding weekends and holidays.
Okay.
And in fact, that is what happened here. The sheriff's office began the eviction on October 5th, and by their own 50A process report, they completed it on October 11th.
Well, yes, except that's what the report says, except it really wasn't complete. There was a skunk.
That's
in
correct.
Premises, so they couldn't complete it, and they went back twice.
That's right.
After the writ expired to complete the eviction.
Yes. They met 799.45.5, which says you have to complete and begin the eviction process within 10 days. However, there were events after the fact, which brings us to the reasonableness test, which is...
What do you mean when you say they completed it within 10 days if it had to be postponed?
They thought they were done. In fact, Deputy Nielsen had filed a paperwork with the court. Then they got a phone call telling them or asking them to come back out to the site. We don't know who made the phone call. They did definitely go back out to the site on October 19th and 20th. They thought they were done with the eviction on October 11th. Turns out they were not. And in terms of their return on October 19th and 20th, again, it was caused by unforeseeable events, including the skunk. The eviction had been 80%.
Well, the skunk was before, right?
That's right. The skunk was on the property on October 10th and 11th.
Right. So they had to abort the eviction, essentially. That's what the records reflect. And they came back on the 19th and 20th and finished up.
I would disagree with that characterization.
Why didn't they shoot the skunk? That's ridiculous to say, skunk, oh, it can't do anything.
Bad things happen when you shoot
a skunk.
Might
bite us.
Was there evidence it was spraying?
No. Can I also just clarify?
I'm bothered by this $50,000 limit. I mean, suppose that his stuff is worth $2 million. I assume it's worth nothing, but suppose it's $2 million. How can a state be permitted to take someone's property that's worth millions and say, well, you know, we just, $50,000 is plenty for you. That's our ceiling.
Well, Your Honor, Parrott, according to this court's decision in Easterhouse, said that Parrott's not limited to minor deprivations and that there can...
Pardon?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear you. Did you say minor deprivation?
That it's not limited to minor...
I don't understand. So the government can steal property worth tens, hundreds of millions of dollars? Well, and what, have a ceiling of 50 cents or what?
Well,
first... What sense does that make? I mean, how does that square with the 14th Amendment process clause?
There's an adequate and meaningful post-deprivation process through
89380. No, not if it's $50,000 ceiling for property worth millions. How is that adequate?
In the first place, the evidence is sketchy about the loss, and in the second place, $50,000 isn't a meaningless number, and they could...
Oh, come on. Doesn't it have to be proportionate in some way to the amount of the taking by the government?
I understand your point.
The government take all the private property in Wisconsin and pay $50,000 for it, or what?
Let me propose to you, Your Honor, that had Mr. Creel gone through one of the multiple state court actions that he initiated and withdrew, then perhaps that would be the case for him to bring back and say that he had an inadequate, non-meaningful process. But that's not what occurred. In February of 06, 9 years ago, he asked for a de novo hearing in the small claims court. In April, he filed a lawsuit against the landlord and 10 John Does. In that same month, he withdrew that claim, and that was for the eviction and his personal property loss. Had he followed through with that, then perhaps he would have a case to bring back to the federal court and say, this is inadequate and non-meaningful. Look at what my damages were. He didn't do that.
Would this claim be subject to Wisconsin's discretionary duty immunity law? In other words, would it be completely immunized?
Whether the deputy sheriff's duties were discretionary or ministerial were not entirely or not fleshed out in the case, but...
That doctrine is in flux, but that's the import of my question.
Yes, I believe that the deputy's duties were immunized because they were discretionary.
So there is no remedy?
The plaintiff could seek remedy through individually going after the defendants.
You just suggested that the sheriff's deputy would be immunized.
Correct.
The plaintiff could go after the private actors, but I'm talking about in terms of public responsibility for the due process claim.
Right. Well, again, it comes down to whether the sheriff was acting in a ministerial or discretionary manner.
Right, but if she, if this act is subject to immunity under Wisconsin's doctrine, then there is no remedy against her. Well, so the remedy is non-existent within the meaning of the Easterhouse decision?
I would disagree that it's a meaningless remedy, Your Honor.
Well, if it's non-existent, how can it be meaningful?
Well, the court would need to determine that, in fact, the deputy...
Right. I mean, none of this has been argued. So we've got, you know, a failure of argument, a failure to raise these issues, a failure of proof, because we don't have anything other than the ball to claim that this property is worth millions of dollars. You know, I mean, it's a horrible record, but these are important questions for the constitutionality of the cap and the availability of an adequate remedy for due process purposes. Mm-hmm. We just don't know the answer, apparently.
I think we need more information. If I can return just briefly to the Wolf Lilly case and why this case is radically different. Wolf Lilly involved a writ that was stale on day one. Here we had a writ that was valid on the first day. Wolf Lilly involved a pervasive, widespread pattern that's absent here. And there was an affirmative link with the sheriff's office there, and the sheriff's failure to properly supervise the process division, and the testimony was indicative of the abuse in that case. We heard from no less than Dean Bowden, who is the author, essentially, of the landlord-tenant laws, and spoke to the intent of the landlord-tenant laws to cure abuses and avoid surprise, and no one could be less surprised in this case than Mr. Creel, who had an eviction case that went on for 6 months, defaulted on numerous stipulations, then had several stays, defaulted on each of the stays, was present at the eviction site nearly every day. During those days was given the opportunity to assess the property that was there, was given input on what he wanted to take, was permitted to look at the trash pile and make a decision on what he wanted to take or not take. In this case, Mr. Creel had a full opportunity, if that goes to your question about the post-deprivation remedy. The facts in this case show that he had ample opportunity before the case to access whatever property he wanted to, Your Honor. Additionally, regardless of what you think of how Judge Randa calculated the clock, the district court, again, considered the expired writ in its analysis, conducted the reasonableness test, and determined that particularly where there's an order for eviction and judicial scrutiny, that it was appropriate that the governmental interest outweighed the private interest here, given that Mr. Creel had been evicted from the property. And there are, again, also the additional factors of unforeseen events that were referenced earlier in the phone call that brought the sheriff's office back to the property. And Your Honor, you mentioned Soledal as well. I would also mention the United States Supreme Court in Soledal determined that a reasonableness inquiry is appropriate in balancing the governmental and privacy interests involved. And the compelling interest here, again, is preventing landlord self-help evictions. In terms of whether there is a penalty or a lesson to be learned here when things don't go as planned, I think this case is proof positive. Here we are 10 years later after the eviction occurred, multiple lawsuits by Mr. Creel and time, energy, and effort on behalf of the county to defend. And again, I believe that the district court made the proper decision, and I would ask that you affirm it.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Foley. Mr. Olson?
Here's the timeline. The original writ was signed on August 24th, was delivered to the sheriff's office on August 29th. We know that from the Nielsen affidavit in the record and in the appendix at Appendix 45. There was a stay issued on September 1st to September 13th. That's Appendix 40. There was another stay ordered on September 21st to September 26th. That stay is memorialized on this paper, Appendix 41. It shows that on the day it was entered, September 21st, the CID eviction clerk and the eviction squad, those are the sheriff's department, was notified of the stay on September 21st. That stay expired on September 26th. Everybody in the district court assumed that the 10 days would start with the expiration of the stay. Judge Randa made up the idea that a writ of restitution had been reissued and re-delivered to the sheriff's department at some point after that stay expired. There's no reason to believe that. They just get the first writ, and then they get notified of these stays, and they have to make sure that they do their job in a timely fashion after the last stay expires. The stay expired on September 26th, so the 10 working days to execute the writ expired on October 11th. The eviction wasn't complete until October 20th. Specifically, the Sheriff's Department was on the premises on these days after the expiration of the writ, this October 12th, October 19th, and October 20th. There are a lot of disputes of fact with respect to what happened at the premises during the course of the eviction. This goes in part to the question about why didn't Dale Kreil save his own property. Well, to read his declaration, he's trying to save it during the eviction at least, and he's being turned away at every opportunity by the county sheriff's department. We could not have successfully proceeded against the sheriff's department. We would have had a big problem with immunity, but we would have had a bigger problem with the damages cap. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Olson and Ms. Foley. Our next case.